It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're with us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday, and we'll get advice on baking Christmas cookies and other holiday favorites.
But first, the budget deal worked out by Representative Paul Ryan and Senator Patty Murray passed the U.S. House yesterday. Now it's expected to go to the Senate next week, removing the threat of a government shutdown for at least the next 2 years.
But Speaker of the House John Boehner was not pleased with criticism from the Tea Party wing of his party and organizations like Heritage Action and others. Joining us to discuss the Speaker's criticism of those critics is Dan DeSalvo. He's Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute's Center for State and Local Leadership and Assistant Professor of Political Science at the City College of New York. Dan, welcome to the show.
My pleasure to be with you.
So as I mentioned, Speaker Boehner lashed out at some of his critics in his own party, saying, quote, they've lost credibility, they're misleading their followers. What do you think led the Speaker to make this criticism of those groups?
Well, I think Speaker Boehner, since the results of the 2012 election came in, has had the most difficult job in Washington. Mm. In a sense, you had 2008 and 2010, and 2012 didn't give a signal of where the country wanted to go, and this has led Speaker Boehner to be this linchpin of what's going to happen in Washington, and he's trying to govern a very factionalized Republican Party in the House. So in some ways it's surprising that he's kept his cool this long and not expressed any frustration with these groups, which is, you know, in some sense mobilized against any potential deal or action that could be crafted under divided government.
Seems like the core question that's making his job so difficult is the idea of controlling the House in divided government. Do you get what you can in a compromise, and Paul Ryan's made that argument about this budget, or hold out for more and just hew closer to principle at the expense of compromise, and Senator Marco Rubio has been making that argument. How do you balance those two ideas of how to manage a divided government?
And I think that is, you put your finger on exactly what's made Speaker Boehner's job so difficult, is in a sense there are two stark alternatives, and one really has to choose. And there's the Tea Party faction of his party, in a sense, many of the activist groups, Heritage Action and others, by taking a strong stand, can score some political points and can win donors and rev up certain parts of the Republican Party base. At the same time, the government needs to continue to function. It needs to continue to work. And if it doesn't, that's going to reflect poorly on Republicans, who will be seen as holding up the show, as we saw with the government shutdown just this past fall.
And speaking of that government shutdown, do you think that was on Paul Ryan's mind, on Speaker Boehner's mind, going into this this budget negotiation, wanting to not get that kind of blame that they got leading up to that shutdown?
I think that they absolutely had to consider it, looking at how far the party's poll numbers had sunk in the wake of the shutdown, and it's sort of pointlessness. Now, Republicans were also bailed out, and they could have even been capitalizing more on the botched rollout of Obamacare. During the shutdown drama, the beginnings of the stories in the press and so on about those difficulties that the Democrats were having were beginning to come out, and they couldn't take advantage of those. And I think Ryan and Boehner would like to focus energy a little bit on the problems on the other side.
I always wonder when we hear stories of rifts within a party, whether Democrats or Republicans, if this is really a substantial thing that's going to cause trouble for the party down the road, or if it's a blip that we in the media get really excited about.
Well, I studied factions in American political parties and wrote a book on the subject, so I take the view that these factions, not in every case, and sometimes they are just a blip on the media radar screen, but sometimes they do end up being more substantial and influencing really what the government does and how one party or the other develops. And in the case of the Tea Party at this point, I think it is a really substantial movement with an organizational infrastructure that can endure at least for a few years and a few election cycles.
But do they pull together, say, in the 2014 elections, and this tiff now won't be a big deal then? Or do you think it's going to be an issue, say, in Republican primaries?
I think it will be an issue in some Republican primaries. So those candidates, you can see this already playing out, especially at the level of many of the senators who are up for re-election, including Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. They're worried about primary challenges coming from the Tea Party wing of the party. So I think that division is there, and that's more problematic at the state level senatorial elections. But in many of the House elections already, you know, the districts that are conservative enough to elect Tea Party members have already done so.
Looking ahead at what this might mean for compromise and bipartisanship in Congress, there's been a lot of talk, of course, about gridlock, especially the shutdown. Does this one compromise, not the grand bargain some people were looking for, but do you think it's an opening for maybe more cases of compromise between Democrats and Republicans?
Right now, given the level of party polarization, I would be betting on it not being a harbinger of great compromises coming down in the future. I think what will moderate the parties in any way are probably decisive signals on the part of Americans when it comes to elections, first here in 2014 and then the presidential election in 2016, that will indicate a direction that's in a sense break or weaken the deadlock or gridlock that's occurring in Washington right now. And then, of course, this can be shifted when some new crisis comes down the pipe that hasn't been foreseen by anyone.
Turning to the other faction, and maybe that's too strong a word, in the Republican Party, there has been some grumbling from establishment Republicans, is the term sometimes used, campaign donors not affiliated with a Tea Party network. Are they excited, do you think, happy to see Speaker Boehner calling out the Tea Party groups and thinking that it's their chance to regain the momentum within their own party?
I think most of those people I don't think that the antagonism has become such that what they would like to see is a more unified party that is an effective governing party. So the tension here is partly between campaigning and governing. The Tea Party has been quite effective as a campaign vehicle of mobilizing energy for the Republicans. But many of those, say, more establishment Republicans also want to an agenda that they can govern on. So I doubt that they're cheering on the speaker to foment conflict within the party, because ultimately it makes the Republicans' task of trying to become the majority party more difficult.
Before we let you go, we wanted to get your thoughts on PolitiFact. That's the fact-checking program started by the Tampa Bay Times, I think. They fact-check statements by politicians. They always give a lie of the year. They gave the award this year to President Obama, saying, if you like your health care plan, you can keep it. That's under the Affordable Care Act. You mentioned the Affordable Care Act earlier. What are your thoughts on that?
I probably think that they were that was far and away the best candidate for their award. You know, in some respects, this was a major strategic error on the part of the president and his team to allow this phrase to be in so many of his speeches when it was widely known and especially voiced by critics when it was first said a while ago that this wasn't true and this wasn't going to play out quite this way, and many of Obama's own staff knew this. They should have, and in part, Obama was ill served by, in a sense, the media, who've been more favorable to the president. They should have picked up on this and listened to some of the critics on this point, and the president wouldn't then be confronted with this now, and he would have been confronted with it right when he first said it.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Dan DeSalvo. He's senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute Center for State and Local Leadership, assistant professor of political science at the City College of New York.
Coming up next, it's Food Friday, and we'll get some advice on making Christmas cookies along with other holiday baking projects.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. It's the holiday season, which for many people means exchanging baked treats, such as cookies.
So for Food Friday, we thought we'd focus on Christmas cookies and other holiday baking with a true expert. Anna Thomas Bates is with us. She's a freelance writer who blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. She writes a weekly column for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's food section. And you can find her writing on babbel.com and at Edible Madison. Anna, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Let's start with a question that vexes me every time I bake with butter. How soft is soft when we're softening our butter for baking?
Well, it's a great question. I have a lot of people ask me why are there cookies after they're finished baking just puddles of, just turn into puddles. They just spread out, and it's likely because your butter was too soft. And I'm guilty of this as well. I'll plan to make cookies. I'll put my butter on the counter in the morning, and by the afternoon, that's when I get around to it. By then, your butter is too soft. It's not going to be able to cream up and capture a lot of air, and it's that air beaten into the butter that gives you really nice structure. So really, you don't need that long. If you have a whole stick of butter, it can soften up in about a half hour. Otherwise, I get it out right before I bake, and I actually cut it up into small slices, put it into the mixer, and by the time I'm ready to get around to it, after putting together the flour, it's the perfect softness to beat up.
I guess that's my problem. I never use the mixer. It frightens me. So I just use a fork, and if I don't have it really soft, my wrist kind of falls apart after stabbing at it for 20 minutes or so.
Well, you are old school. You should get at least an electric hand mixer, but if you've been a good little boy, you should get yourself a stand mixer because it's really an easy way to make really good cookies.
I'll put that on my list.
All right, and we'll put in a good word to Santa as well for that. I want to start with a broader philosophical question. You know, cookies during the holiday season are almost like the perfect thing to make because they come in so many shapes, so many flavors, so many sizes, and everybody in the family can help.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I mean, who doesn't like a cookie? And if you don't like one kind of cookie, there's going to be another kind of cookie that you're going to enjoy. And there's not a lot of technical ability or a fuss to it. You know, you really dump everything into a mixer or a bowl and use a fork like Rob, and you mix it all up and plop it onto a baking sheet, and then just don't bake it too long, which is my second big tip. Overdone cookies are no good.
So let's talk about that, because having baked cookies myself many times, I am a victim of having baked too long. How do you make sure you don't do that? How do you make sure you wind up with a nice, you know, crisp on the bottom but not burnt?
Sure. Well, your first batch is going to be your test batch. Usually you're doing multiple trays of cookies in one batch. And basic rule of thumb is if you can smell the cookie baking, it's ready to come out of the oven and probably was ready to come out about a minute earlier. So take a peek in, look through the window. When your cookie looks just done on top, almost underbaked but not raw, and is just slightly golden around the edges, that's when it's ready to come out. Let it cool on the baking sheet for 1 or 2 minutes, and then go ahead and use a nice spatula and take it over onto a cooling rack, and they'll firm up right away.
Now, the flagship of the holiday cookie, of the Christmas cookie, is the sugar cutout cookie. That's the one I always steer toward when it's on the platter. What advice do you have on making those as good as you can?
Sure. With a sugar cutout cookie, one of my best tips is after you cut out the cookie and have it all laid out on the tray ready to bake, pop it into the freezer for a couple minutes. And then when you bake it, it's going to hold its shape really nicely and not puff up or spread out.
So wait, after you cut it into the shapes, it goes in the freezer for a couple?
Yes. So cut it into the shapes, put it on the baking tray, and then just slide it into the freezer for a little while.
This explains everything. I'm taking notes here. Of course, now after the cookie is done, I mean, some people prefer a plain cookie. I am not
wrong.
One of those people. I prefer something a little more festive, something with more calories on it, perhaps. Give me some ideas about making something attractive and yet simple.
Sure. If you want to go really basic, before you actually bake the cookie, you can buy something called sanding sugar, which is a nice colored, sparkly sugar. You can get white as well. And you sprinkle that onto the cookie, and then you bake it. And then it comes out already decorated and sparkly and pretty and colorful. Otherwise, just make a basic icing. And I like to pick shapes that you can ice all in one color and they still look good. So like a snowflake, a star, a Christmas tree. You know, you don't have to get fancy with a lot of different colors icings unless you want to. And then after that, you can add a few embellishments. Like for a green Christmas tree, you can add just a couple of those red sugar beads. And there you have ornaments. Or a little red nose for a Rudolph. Or for a snowflake, just white sanding sugar looks really great on top of white icing. So you can be very, very simple but have a really attractive cookie.
Our producer Galen is getting worked up about frosting over there. He says he's wondering about soft versus hard frosting. He says nobody likes hard frosting. It's got to be soft.
You know, I actually have, I'm middle of the road. I don't like the super soft frosting because then it just kind of makes a big mess when you try to pack it up. And I don't like the royal icing, which is the really hard icing that, you know, professional decorators use because it doesn't taste well. And I actually have a recipe on my blog where it's just powdered sugar, a little bit of milk, and a tiny bit of honey or corn syrup. And it goes on thin, and it stays pliable, but it will dry enough within a few hours that you can actually stack cookies without messing them up. So I kind of go middle of the road with the frosting versus icing debate.
And speaking of stacking cookies, you know, it's one thing to have them in the jar or something, but these are going to be out for family and friends to see. I just put them in a pile, but I've been advised by several people close to me that's not the way to do business. So give me some tips.
Sure. If you really want to have a nice platter, if you're going to make more than one cookie, and you don't have to, if you've got a really great family recipe or you're really good at a single cookie, make a whole bunch of those and give those away. But if you're going to put together a platter, it's kind of like designing a menu. You want to have complementary and contrasting flavors and textures. You always want to have something chocolate. You always want something with a little bit of color, like a sugar cutout cookie. I think something with dried fruits and nuts are very festive. And I also like to have something that's not a cookie on my platter, either a little bit of spiced nuts or some shards of toffee or a little truffle, just something to kind of break up all the cookiness. Mix and match and have some diversity, and it'll make for a really beautiful and delicious cookie platter.
What are some of your other favorite cookies to make and maybe advice on making them to go alongside those sugar cookies?
Oh, sure. If you were thinking of chocolate cookies, there's chocolate crackles is a popular one. That's a dark chocolate with a powdered sugar coating, and then as it bakes, it kind of melts down and has a crackly appearance, and that's a standard favorite. People love the thumbprint cookies, and you can do those in all manners of flavors. You can have a jam thumbprint with a little bit of strawberry jam in the top, or people will put in a Hershey's Kiss or a little dab of ganache for their thumbprint cookie. I also really love shortbread. It's nice to have something that has a nice defined shape, and it's real dense and not too sweet, but very buttery. I have a brown sugar whole wheat shortbread that I like to make, and there's lots of other really nice shortbread recipes out there. It's nice to have a bar cookie, and there's all manners of different types of bar cookies, ones that have lots of nuts and pretzels and crunchy things, and that adds a lot of texture to your plate. But really, if your butter's not too soft and you don't overbake things, and you're using good ingredients, you're not going to go wrong. Also, if you're going to make a new cookie, make sure you're using it from a well-tested source. There's so many opportunities out there to get recipes, and some I find are very good and well-tested, and others not so much. So it's nice to go to a source that has a lot of well-tested recipes.
What about cookies that have to travel? And what I'm thinking about are cookies you might make up a gift pack for family members. You might take them with you on a trip. They're in the trunk of the car. There's something like that. Are there any particular kind that are going to wind up in one piece like the way they left home?
You know, there's sturdy, and then there's cookies that don't dry out. And I think a good combination of the two is again, the shortbread. It's really rich. Shortbread has a lot of butter, so it's not going to dry out and honestly still tastes really great a week or two after you make them, if they actually last that long. And they're pretty sturdy as well, so shortbread is a nice one to pack up and either mail or take with you in the car.
So any thoughts in our last minute or so on non-cookies, other good things to bake around the holidays? What else do you have planned maybe for a holiday meal?
Oh, sure. Other than sweets?
Other than the cookies, yeah.
Other than the cookies, sure. Well, I like to do a big Christmas brunch, and we'll do breakfast, and we'll have a big fruit salad. We'll have cinnamon rolls, which are sweet, but that's always a big part of it. I like to do an oven-baked bacon glazed with a little bit of cayenne and honey. And, you know, we'll probably have a ham at some point during that day as well.
Oven-baked bacon glazed?
Yes.
Wow. That's all we can say.
You had us a glazed bacon there. Yeah.
And to turn you back to the cookies really quick, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel annually does a holiday cooking contest where people turn in their best family recipes, and we got a lot of really good ones this year. And this year they put them all together in an ebook, so you can get all the past year's winner if you go to jsonline.com/ebook.
Ooh, do we know what the winner was on that yet?
Yes, it was an Italian fig cookie. So it's a sugar cookie with a little bit of frosting stuffed with this wonderful filling that had fig and coffee and lemon juice and brown sugar. It was really delicious.
Wow, that sounds great for the season.
Yeah.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for joining us. A lot of fun, as always.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
To you, too.
Bye-bye.
That was Anna Thomas-Bates. She's a freelance writer. She blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com and writes for the Journal Sentinel's food section.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we're going to be talking to an expert about the most popular baby names from 2013.
And we'll see if the movies and TV shows are big influences. Katniss's from the Hunger Games, maybe.
Possibly.
Arya from Game of Thrones.
I'm still hoping for Eugene to make that
Eugene,
big comeback.
Someday, yeah. Man. Your day will come. We'll also hear the story behind a hard-to-find particle that could hold the secret of the universe.
And we'll be asking a science teacher our most burning questions about how everyday stuff works.
We'll also keep on top of the news of the day. That's all coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, does the U.S. Constitution need a rewrite? Our guest says the founders never intended the Constitution to be a sacred document. It's time to make some changes. I'm Rob Farrick.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickert. She'll be back on Wednesday.
Veronica's been away to a death in her family. Our thoughts are with her and her family.
Coming up, with tomorrow's anniversary of the Sandy Hook school shooting, our guest has policy ideas to help keep guns out of the hands of potential mass shooters.
First, is the United States Constitution due for a rewrite? It's risen almost to the status of a sacred text, but our guest says it was never intended to be that, and it has a lot of flaws that cause trouble in today's political world.
The issue came up this week with a gathering of mostly Republican state lawmakers who are hoping to start the process of a constitutional convention.
Sanford Levinson joins us now. He's professor of government at the University of Texas. His books include Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It. Most recently, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Sanford, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, did we have that right? Have we started to treat the Constitution as an almost sacred text in this country?
Sure. I think that's been really pervasive since World War II. What I think is interesting is that if you look at the treatment of the Constitution over our entire history, you find a somewhat more realistic stance toward it. People respected it. They admired it. But I think it was really World War II and the belief that somehow or other it was the Constitution that we were fighting for and that enabled us to win the war against the dictatorships that really turned it into a much more sacred kind of object. And then for political liberals, it was Brown versus the Board of Education, because until after World War II, most political liberals, most people who would define themselves as progressives, were not great admirers of the Constitution. It was viewed basically as a way to preserve the status quo, initially to protect slavery. But once Brown versus Board came along, and then 20 years later, Roe versus Wade comes along, liberals fall in love with the Supreme Court and therefore the Constitution.
Did the framers, the people who wrote the Constitution, think of it as a timeless document that was, you know, it could be amended, but the core should stick with us forever?
No, I think most of them were hopeful, but only cautiously hopeful, that it might work for 25 or 30 years.
Really?
Before needing, because after all, you have to remember that the 1787 Constitution is our second Constitution. The first one, the Articles of Confederation, is ratified in 1781, and it lasts a grand total of 6 years. So the framers were very smart and sophisticated people. They knew that it was difficult to structure a government, that the Articles of Confederation hadn't worked, So let's try something new. And there was certainly some optimism that it would work, not least because you had George Washington there to give it his, you know, unique sort of support, and he became the first president. But it does include an amendment provision, Article 5, and I think that people from the founding generation would truly be shocked to discover that there has not been another constitutional convention since 1787.
Let's fast forward to now. We have the Constitution, more or less, as it started off there. What are some of your key objections to the Constitution and how it affects us today?
Well, you begin with the fact that the people who drafted the Constitution really were basically opposed to a party system and certainly had no comprehension of the kind of party system that we live under now. So if you look at the structure that they created, and that we really do live under today, the amendments have not changed what I'm going to be talking about all that much. You have a system that makes it far, far easier to block legislation than to pass legislation. I often ask my students which side they would rather be on in the legislation game, on offense or defense. And if you're playing offense, what you have to do is to capture two separate houses of Congress plus the presidency. You can always veto a law passed by Congress, and then it may very well be that you need to capture the Supreme Court as well because it can strike down legislation. If you're playing defense, all you have to do is capture one house of Congress. It really doesn't matter if you lose the House or the Senate because the other house can block. And even if legislation can get through both houses of Congress, if the president is antagonistic to the legislation, then it just disappears with the stroke of the veto pen. And so I think most people today, whether they're left, right, or center, are correctly frustrated when they look at Washington and believe whatever their particular agenda might be, that it's very unlikely that Congress is really going to move effectively to confront it. And you know, part of the reason is political polarization. Part of the reason is the way we finance elections. Part of the reason is talk radio and cable radio and, you know, stuff that a lot of people talk about. But I do think that part of the reason that we don't talk about very much is this set of 18th century institutions that's really not a good match for the country we've become and the political system that we've become.
But I have seen an argument that the thing you just described, the difficulty of passing something new, is a positive feature, not a bug. It keeps us from radical change. It keeps us from rapidly tacking back and forth as parties change. It provides stability in the long run.
Well, yeah, it certainly provides a big boost to maintain the status quo, whatever the status quo is. If people are relatively content with the status quo, then you're right. It will provide a certain kind of stability. And if you complain, then people tell you, just lighten up. Things aren't so bad, and maybe they'll get better. But if you have a lot of people who really aren't content, they're scared to death about keeping their jobs. They really wonder about health insurance. They're really concerned about getting a handle on entitlement spending. They're really concerned about either too much immigration or unfair treatment of the immigrants who are here. They're really concerned about global warming, energy. Then to be told lighten up is just not a very satisfying answer. And I think that most people today are more frustrated about what they see in the future. 60 to 70% of the population, when they're polled, think the country is going the wrong direction. So to tell them that just to accept the status quo, what they say is, well, the status quo increasingly looks as if we're going over a cliff, and why should we accept it?
So what kind of changes do you think would help address the problems you're talking about in our if we had a chance to change the Constitution?
You know, my answer to that depends, frankly, on what seems to be most important at any given time. If you had asked me this question several years ago, I would have said that it's really a mistake that we're stuck with presidents for fixed four-year terms if we genuinely lose confidence in the judgment of the president on matters of life and death, war and peace. There ought to be some way to fire a president, the way you can do in a parliamentary system.
Short of impeachment, which requires something
impeachment
criminal.
Impeachment is useless. Yeah. You know, quite frankly, I'm less afraid of a crook as president than I am of a president with truly bad judgment on fundamental issues. You can be honest as day is long and sincere and still have appallingly bad judgment. Today, I think I would emphasize the gridlock nature of that's promoted by bicameralism of the kind we have. I also generally detest the Senate, even though, given my own politics, I prefer the politics of the current Senate to the politics of the current House of Representatives. But there really is no defense in the 21st century that Wyoming has the same number of senators as California or Vermont, the same number of senators as Texas, even though I personally love Vermont's two senators, and I'm not a big fan. I live in Texas, teach at the University of Texas. I'm not a big fan of Texas's two senators, but that still doesn't add up to a justification that Vermont and Texas should have the same number of representatives, where the states, I think Texas is something like 35 times the population of Vermont.
We're talking to Sanford Levinson. He's professor of government, as he mentioned, at the University of Texas. He's making the case that we need to rewrite the United States Constitution.
And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think about the idea of rewriting the U.S. Constitution? It's been over 225 years since the last Constitutional Convention. Is it time to have another one? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And let us know what you think or ask a question of our guest. You can also email us, talk@WPR.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We continue our conversation now with Sanford Levinson of the University of Texas. He's making the case that the U.S. Constitution is flawed in its present form, out of date, and it's time for a rewrite.
And you can join in. Do you agree that the Constitution needs to be changed or overhauled? What changes would you like to see, or do you think we should keep our hands off? You can call 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. To callers in just a moment, but Sanford, first, you're not the only one thinking along these lines. You mentioned that your loyalties are a little more toward the Democratic side of the ticket, but a meeting of state lawmakers, mostly Republicans, happened this week, led in part by a lawmaker from here in Wisconsin, trying to get the state legislatures to pave the road to a constitutional convention. What do you think about that?
Well, frankly, at this point, I'm somewhat sympathetic to almost any movement that at least suggests that we need to talk about whether the Constitution really serves us very well today. There's no doubt that there are huge differences of opinion as to what should be done. And it's altogether possible that if we had a constitutional convention, nothing much would in fact happen because there just wouldn't be sufficient agreement on what we should do. But part of the real problem is that, at least in recent years, we've worshipped the Constitution more than we've really discussed to what degree it has undeniable strengths and to what degree does it have weaknesses. In recent weeks, I've taken to using the metaphor of the annual checkup or taking your car in for a tune-up, that what you want to do is to maintain your car or maintain your body by having it checked up regularly. The good news is you really don't need to do very much, but it's very helpful to have the checkup. We're not in the habit of checking up on the Constitution or asking if it needs a tune-up or new brakes or the like. So I really do hope that this effort to get states to pass petitions calling for a new convention, I wish them well, because I think that is the equivalent in its own way of being hit by a 2x4. And that might get the attention of editorial writers and pundits and maybe even some major political figures to start asking, why do so many people these days think that maybe we do need to take the Constitution in for a genuine deep checkup?
Let's see what our callers have to say. We have Adam on the line in Stevens Point. Adam, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
So basically, I think one of the biggest things is that I think nowadays with especially on like the Tea Party side, I think there would be a lot of hesitation going forward with something like this because there's such animosity towards politicians and the idea that politicians are basically doing with what they want. In Washington, and if you were to go ahead with something like reforming the Constitution, I think people would be afraid that politicians, when they would go ahead and write this or whoever, they would be fabricating it in a way that they could go ahead with, it would give them more autonomy, and it would give them more freedom to do with what they wanted with the Constitution.
Adam, thanks for the call. So if we don't trust them to pass laws, why would we trust them to change the Constitution?
No, Adam is raising a very, very good point. I think that one of the real problems, frankly, with the Constitution, and it's a kind of catch-22, that what the Constitution says is that Congress has to call a new convention if two-thirds of the states petition it to do so. That'd be 34 states. What the Constitution doesn't do is to give you the slightest clue as to how that convention really would operate, including how delegates would be chosen. So Adam's fear is a justified fear, because if you allow me or any other, you know, single person or single group to pick the delegates, then I can tell you what sorts of changes they might want or what part of the status quo they might think are just terrific. So I think part of the discussion, especially if we get from 12 to 20 or 20 to 25 states who really do pass these petitions, part of the public discussion has to be, how do we choose the delegates? It's not going to be Congress choosing the delegates. I think almost every lawyer who's looked into this agrees that that would be unconstitutional for Congress to choose the delegates. So who does? Is it an election? And is it appointment by state governors? My own choice, and this might be an illustration of the principle that if you're going to hang for a lamb, you may as well go all the way and hang for a sheep. What I would like is that delegates be chosen basically at random, the way we choose jurors, and that we would end up with, let's say, 700 or 750 fellow Americans, good and true, some of whom we would undoubtedly regard as crazy, some of whom we would rejoice in discovering who they are. But I think that if we did it that way, you wouldn't be worried about the kind of capture that Adam is justifiably worried about. And I think a lot of this boils down to whether we have any faith in the 21st century in the ability of, you know, our fellow citizens really to think deeply and seriously about the problems that we that confront us and come up with suggestions. Now, a convention can't rewrite the Constitution in the sense that whatever they say goes. All a convention can do is to offer proposed changes. It's ultimately up to, I think, state legislatures or conventions in each state to decide whether or not to accept these proposals. But what I think would be wonderful about a convention, assuming that the delegates are chosen in a non-outrageous way, is that it would be the ultimate in a national reality television show, because I assume this would be covered by C-SPAN. I assume that public radio stations would cover it very closely. And I think it would turn many, many Americans who are turned off from politics into Constitution junkies.
Interesting. I want to get one more caller in before we're done. Eric is with us in Madison. Eric, hi.
Hello. I was wondering if there's any push for when this gets done, or if it gets done, for addressing the lack of support for third parties, if you like.
Eric, we don't have too much time left, but yeah, the two-party system isn't in our current Constitution. Could it be freed up to allow for a multi-party system?
Sure. I mean, one of my friends, Larry Lessig, who teaches at the Harvard Law School, and he and I taught a seminar this semester on what a new convention might look like. Larry is probably the leading person in the country who is really and truly worried about the way we finance elections and how this creates a certain kind of what he views as a basically corrupt two-party system. And I think that undoubtedly a constitutional convention would have to address the fact, as I said before, the original Constitution was written by people who wanted to head off the creation of any political parties. That's not the world we live in. And one of the things that a convention should certainly talk about is what sort of party system we want and how different sorts of election systems or different sorts of campaign finance systems would, in fact, encourage the creation of third or fourth parties, which I would love to see. Most countries in the world are multi-party. We generally are not, and I don't think we're well served by what sometimes is called the two-party duopoly.
Sanford, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That was Sanford Levinson. He's professor of government at the University of Texas. His books include Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong.
Coming up on the program, tomorrow is the anniversary of the school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, and we'll be hearing about proposals to keep guns away from potential mass shooters. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.